My dear brothers and sisters, we've thought of Zerubbabel returning, first of all, constructing the altar, and then, a few years later, the temple with the help of Joshua the high priest. We thought of Ezra coming 57 years later to try and encourage the people to settle themselves once more and follow the word of God and those things which he had taught them. And then, a mere 12 years later, and along comes Nehemiah, who was given two tasks to complete. We probably thought it was only one. We always connected Nehemiah with the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Well, just notice this. If you turn to Nehemiah chapter 2, when Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem, he goes to examine the walls, see what state they're in. Chapter 2 and verse 12, took a few men with him. He didn't tell any man what God had put in his heart to do at Jerusalem. Now, we know what that work was. God had put in his heart to rebuild Jerusalem, to make it secure, to fortify it, to rebuild the walls. But that was only half of the work. If you now turn over to chapter 7, verse 4, now the city was large and great, but the people were few therein, and the houses were not builded, and my God put into mine heart to gather together the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be reckoned by genealogy. Now the second part of Nehemiah's work was to ensure a viable population within the city. It's all very well building walls, but if they were walls that were providing security only for a few people, it was pretty pointless. So it was now necessary to bring people into Jerusalem. And those that volunteered for the work were highly honoured by those who much preferred to stay in their own inheritances in the villages surrounding Jerusalem. But it's this twofold work of Nehemiah that we must try and remember this morning. Because the building of the walls, it isn't that God is concerned with stones and with mortar. So the Apostle Peter tells us it's the living stones he's concerned with. And the walls, the physical walls around Jerusalem, would have been absolutely valueless had there been no people there. So Nehemiah didn't just return to rebuild walls. He returned in order that he could establish a city of people whose praise was in the name of the Lord of hosts. Now the importance of walls and gates is brought before us in a number of places in Scripture. Probably the definitive example is in the 5th chapter of the prophecy of Isaiah, where a parable is told. It's a parable which we find being repeated in different places throughout Scripture. And you might like just to, at some stage, find all the other occasions when godly men rested on their understanding of this parable and brought out new lessons from it. The Lord Jesus Christ himself used it on at least two occasions for a parable and on two other occasions just as an analogy of his own work. But in Isaiah chapter 5, the prophet says, I will sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. He fenced it, gathered out the stones thereof, planted it with the choicest vine, built a tower in the midst of it, and also made a wine press therein. He looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. What should happen? What more could I have done to my vineyard? Verse 5, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge, the wall, it shall be eaten up. Break down the wall, it shall be trodden down. I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged. There shall come up briars and thorns. I will command the clouds, they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, the men of Judah his pleasant plant. He looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. And we don't have to be very clever to realise that what's being spoken of here is the time immediately prior to the captivity, the ungodliness of the people, who were not prepared at all to return to God the praises due to his name. He said, look at all the care that's been bestowed upon you. You've been protected on every side. All the stones of stumbling have been taken away and put around as a wall of defence. There was a tower in the midst that the watchman should have climbed to see the enemy coming. There was a wine press there. The sacrifice was possible for forgiveness of sins, and they had forsaken the God who had given them strength. And because of that, what more could be done to his people? And as they turned their back on him, so for a time he would turn his back on them. And that security would be taken away, the wall would be destroyed, it would become a haunt of jackals, no longer would it be fruitful, thorns and briars would grow there. Those thorns that were introduced first of all as a result of the disobedience of man, and which we see in their final and most dastardly part in the purpose of God, when they were pressed on the brow of his son, the symbol of disobedience on the head of the only one who has ever been obedient. All of these things are found in this little parable, and we can open it out and discover more and more as we go through. But there's another aspect to the parable which Nehemiah introduces us to, and it's this. We must look on this also as a parable of our own lives. This is the life of discipleship to which we've been called. Until we came to a knowledge of the things of God, we were like a hillside covered with stones. Do you remember what Jesus said in his parable, the pattern parable of the sower, which also rests on his understanding of Isaiah chapter 5? Because remember, there was rocky ground, and there was thorny ground, and there was good ground in the parable of the sower. He said that those where the rocks were, it allowed no depth of earth. The roots couldn't sink down. So in our lives, we've got to remove the rocks. And this parable tells us where we're to put them. We're to build them as a wall, as Nehemiah rebuilt the wall of Jerusalem. We've got to make sure that there are no thistles there. And the parable of the sower tells us, in very graphic language, that the thorns and thistles are the cares of this world and the delight in riches, which is a lovely way of summing up all the things that this world strives after. And instead we're to make it good ground. The prophet said here it would not be pruned or digged. There shall come up briars and thorns. And the prophet Jeremiah said, break up your fallow ground, plant not among the thorns. So we can't do that. We've got to clear out the ground. We've got to start making sure that there's a watchtower in our lives, looking out for the evil, the enemy without and the enemy within. And we're never to forget that there's a wine press there. And we'll remember that when we come to break bread and drink wine together. So all of those things, I believe, were understood by Nehemiah. These were the things that he prayed for. And when he understood as well that the city was in reproach, that the walls were broken down, the gates and the stones were burned with fire, it wasn't the walls that he was bothered about, but it was the purpose of God which was symbolised in the walls around Jerusalem. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, by the sides of the north, the city of the great king. And it wasn't. Not at that time, anyway. Nor is it yet. In fact, if you look at Jerusalem from the north, so I'm told by those that have been to the land, it doesn't look very much at all. But the time will come when it will. So there is something still to wait for. Turn to John chapter 10. And can you believe that when the Lord spoke these words, he wasn't remembering what Isaiah had written in Isaiah chapter 5. Verily I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same as a thief and a robber. He that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name. Verse 7, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture. Notice, if any man enter in by me, he shall be saved. Walls shall God provide for salvation. And the gates, well, they're called praise, aren't they? As Isaiah brings before us in his prophecy. So these were the things that it seems were understood by Nehemiah. Turn into Psalm 137. We thought earlier in the week of the despair of the people as they were in captivity by the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there they that carried us away captive required of us a song. They that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Now all those things were the things which so encouraged Nehemiah to get down on his knees day after day through those 3 long months, when he was praying that God would arise and stop his name being a reproach among the heathen. But the whole point of this is that we are to be like Nehemiah. No point is just looking at Nehemiah and saying, well, it's interesting, yes, we discover what he did, and we can imagine him on his tour of inspection around the walls, and later organising the builders, and remarkably finishing the wall in less than 2 months. Not that at all. Oh yes, we can discover those things, but what we've got to appreciate is that we are to have this same feeling that Nehemiah had. We are really by rivers of Babylon, sitting down and weeping, because at the moment Zion is not a joy in the earth. The time will come when it will be, but at the moment it's not. But the people are being regathered. It's almost as if we're at the Zerubbabel and Joshua stage. The people are back in the land, but they're not resting themselves on the Lord their God. And we're waiting for the coming of the greater than Nehemiah, the one whom he prefigured, who will take the stones that have been formed outside the site and build them into the wall of the city, a city that lieth 4 square, we're told. There was a little phrase in that reading we had from Psalm 122. This is the obverse to Psalm 137. Psalm 137 starts with them weeping as they were in Babylon, hanging their harps on the trees there. Now in Psalm 122, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go unto the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. And then this is the verse, verse 3. Jerusalem is builded together as a city that is compact together. When Tyndale translated the Bible into English, he said as a city at unity within itself. That's a lovely phrase, isn't it? You can't have the city of Zion being a praise in the earth if there is disunity there. So part of the preparation of being built into the city is ensuring that if we have aught against our brother, we leave our gift and first make peace with our brother before we go. And the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, to give thanks unto the name of the Lord. Well, remembering that those are the things we are meant to be seeing as we look through this work of Nehemiah. Now let's go back to Nehemiah chapter 2. Remember, he told no one what was in his heart, what God had put in his heart to do at Jerusalem. Verse 12 of Nehemiah 2. Neither was there any beast with me, save the beast that I rode upon. And he goes out on his tour of inspection. Now, I hope you've all got very good imaginations, because I want you to imagine that my hand is Jerusalem. Right? There's a central valley, okay, and there's the Valley of Hinnom and the Kidron Valley on the eastern side. We're told here in verse 13 that Nehemiah went out by night by the valley gate before the Dragon's Well to the Dung Gate. Now, the Dung Gate and the Valley Gate both opened out onto the Valley of Hinnom. The Dung Gate, where all the refuse was taken out. Next week I shall be able to say, trash. Right? And burnt in the Valley of Hinnom. The Valley Gate was also named after the Valley of Hinnom, so they were fairly close together. But let's just say the Valley Gate was at the junction of the Tarapean Valley and the Valley of Hinnom. So he came out here. You can see which way round the city he went. Verse 14, I went on to the gate of the fountain and the king's pool. Now the king's pool was at the end of the lovely water supply of Jerusalem. The water supply that started outside the city walls at Gihon, the Virgin's Fountain, where Solomon was crowned king, if you look in 1 Kings chapter 2. Came in under the walls through Hezekiah's conduit and wound its way round. Finally feeds the pool of Siloam, we thought earlier in the week, the pool that means sent. And then the water, when it's filled the pool of Siloam, flows over and waters the king's garden. Now you can think of that as a parable as well. That's a parable of the believer's life, which starts at the Virgin's Fountain, the place where the people went to wash their clothing, because it was by the Fuller's Field when Rabshakeh, Sennacherib's general, came to wave his sword at Jerusalem. He stood by the conduit in the Fuller's Field, Gihon, the spring. Enters into the walls of safety, which we do at baptism. And gradually, being formed through the rock, until we reach the pool of Siloam, where sight is given. Finally, when the Lord returns, able to tumble over into the king's garden. Lovely, isn't it? Well, that was that point there. So we've moved round from the Valley Gate to the Dung Gate, round near the king's fountain in verse 14, King's Pool. I went up in the night by the brook, verse 15 tells us, because the end of the previous verse, there wasn't any room for the beast that was by him to pass. So he's reached this point in the southeast corner of the city, and the walls were so tumbled down that he had to move out into the Kidron Valley and look at the walls from across the valley. And the indication that's given to us from Nehemiah chapter 2 is that this portion of the walls were in most disrepair. Not surprising in a way, because they're built on the steepest hillside of the walls of Jerusalem. And it would be the easiest place to remove and destroy them. And then he continued his circuit, it seems, and re-entered by the Valley Gate, the gate from which he started. And having carried out that tour of inspection, he was then in a position to organise his troops. And it's chapter 3 that tells us how he did this. This chapter, which is full of long names, very difficult for us to read. But what we learn from this is the way that he apportioned the work. He put the people to build the wall near to where they lived, so that we find, for example, the priests rebuilding the sheep gate. And the sheep gate was so named because that was where the animals were brought for sacrifice. It was near the temple. There's a big lesson in that for us. It might be easy to go somewhere else and preach about the things that we hold dear. The most difficult place to do the work, the most difficult place to live a life of discipleship, is in our everyday, humdrum, mundane occupations. But that's where we're asked to do it. We're not asked to do the grand things. If they come our way, all very well, let's do them. But what we are asked to do is each day, carefully, to show forth the praises of him who called us from darkness and has brought us to light. But Nehemiah was a wonderful man. Look at this group of people that are mentioned in verse 5 of Nehemiah chapter 3. Next unto Zadok, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles put not their necks to the work of their Lord. Now you can imagine a man like Nehemiah, who was a man of action, and how he felt about these people who didn't do their work properly. Just cast your eye down now to verse 27 of Nehemiah 3. After them, the Tekoites repaired another piece. So here was Nehemiah. He said, well, I gave you a part to do. You haven't done it very well. You didn't put your backs into it, which is the phrase we would use, not our necks. You didn't put your backs into the work. I'll give you another piece. And we say, good for Nehemiah. That's just a way to deal with it. Perhaps that's how we ought to be dealt with too. If we don't succeed properly the first time, then give us some more work to do to see if we can do it right the next. But that's not the only thing that Nehemiah did with the Tekoites. We've only read half of verse 27. Look at the piece he gave them to build. The bit over against the great tower that lieth out, even unto the wall of Ophel. Now, let's go back to Jerusalem. That's down here. Remember, we've already discovered how badly damaged the wall was there. We've already discovered the reason for it, and that's because it's on the steep hillside. But this is by the great tower that lies out. Now you can look at a map of the walls of Jerusalem and you see that it goes straight for a while and then changes direction. And at the change of direction you have a tower built. Now that's all very well till you come to a point where the ground is falling away from you. And this was the tower that lieth out. It didn't only lie out, it was built over a precipice. And that was the part he gave to the Tekoites. You haven't done your job right, first of all. I've saved the best bit for you. Now have a go at this. You know, I think that piece of wall and that tower was always falling down. Do you remember Luke 13 and verse 1? The tower in Siloam, which fell, killing the people who were trying to rebuild it. Don't you think it was the same tower that the Tekoites were put to try and build, the one that was set out over the Kidron Valley, the difficult one, the one where the foundations were always shifting, the one where you needed good workmanship in order for it to be built, and that was the one he gave to the Tekoites. Now, if Nehemiah really is the type of Christ that we believe him to be, isn't there a rather threatening thought here? And that is, if we are slapdash in the work we do for the Lord, then a problem is going to be presented to us 10, 20, 100 times worse than the one that we didn't put our backs into dealing with. Because that's the way the Lord works. We're not tested beyond that we are able, but the inference is that we are tested up to that which we are able. And here, the Tekoites were given that sort of work. Well, they then built the wall. Chapter 4. We've seen this in verse 3 when we were thinking of the adversaries, that Tobiah the Ammonite, even that which they build, if a fox go up, shall break down their stone wall. Mockery, sneering, cynicism from this man. And Nehemiah's response, hear, O our God, we are despised. Turn their reproach upon their own head. Give them for a prey in the land of captivity. Verse 6, so built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. Now, if you'd been Nehemiah, how would you have organised the work of rebuilding the wall? Remember, you've discovered that, so far as Jerusalem is concerned, it's this part that is worst? When you said, look, I'll throw all my troops there, all the builders will first of all settle themselves here and we'll build that piece of wall, we'll make it really secure. Well, that may be what we would do, but it wasn't what Nehemiah did. Nehemiah realised what we ought to realise, that half a wall is worse than no wall at all, because it gives a semblance of security when there is no security at all. The enemy can go round the back and attack you from behind. So when we read in verse 6 of Nehemiah 4, the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, it doesn't mean there was only half a wall, it means it had been built to half its height. The important words there are that it was joined together. Now that's what makes a wall secure. So the wall was all the way around. The gates weren't there yet. The gates weren't there when it reached its full height either. We'll come to that in a moment. But he had made the city secure. There was a wall all the way around it, but only half the height. The people had a heart to work. Quite often when you read mind in the Bible, it means heart. They had a heart to work. And that, of course, created a problem. Tobiah, the Arabians, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, when they heard that it was proceeding apace, they really began to get themselves very concerned. And then finally, the wall is built completely. Still no gates, but the gates could be defended by placing gatekeepers there who would watch for attack. 52 days, and the whole wall was completed. But Nehemiah had a memory like an elephant. He'd not forgotten what Tobiah the Ammonite said about the quality of their workmanship. Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall break down their stone wall. Turn to chapter 12 of Nehemiah. Verse 27, they're going to dedicate the wall. Well, how would you do it? How would you go about dedicating the wall of Jerusalem? Well, you gather all the people into one place and choose the appropriate psalms and songs to be sung. The right words will be spoken. Well, that's what they did. But it was prefaced by something which proved to the adversaries that Nehemiah had heard what they had said and was going to show how wrong their words had been. So, verse 27, they brought the Levites out of their places. They came with thanksgivings and singing, with cymbals, psalteries and harps. They gathered themselves out of the plain country round about Jerusalem, and from the villages of the Netophathites, from the house of Gilgal, the fields of Geba and Azmaveth. For the singers had builded them villages round about Jerusalem. They got themselves in a position where they could come up to Jerusalem to carry out the temple worship. Priests and the Levites purified themselves, the people, the gates, and the wall. Now here is where Nehemiah's showmanship comes to play. I brought up the princes of Judah upon the wall and appointed two great companies of them that gave thanks, whereof one went on the right hand upon the wall toward the dung gate. Now, let's remember our city of Jerusalem and how Nehemiah inspected the walls. Remember, he came out of the valley gate to the dung gate, round near the king's pool, and in this direction. And the first group of people, he divided the people into two, the first group of people went the same way that Nehemiah had gone. So they start to go anti-clockwise around Jerusalem. There is then another group of people. Verse 38. The other company of them that gave thanks went over against them, and I after them, and the half of the people upon the wall from beyond the Tower of the Furnaces, even unto the broad wall, and from above the gate of Ephraim, above the old gates, above the fish gate. Now, that's all round the other way. He's now going clockwise, and they started off from the valley gate. So you've got one group of people going anti-clockwise, another group of people going clockwise, and Nehemiah has said that they went And the Revised Version in verse 38 doesn't say over against them. They went to meet them. So they're going to meet at one point. No guesses as to where they're going to meet. If they left there, and one group went that way, and the other group went that way, even I can work out they're going to meet up there, assuming they're going at the same speed, and that's where they did meet. And what's up there in Jerusalem? The temple. Alright? Where you'd expect them to be, the broad place and the temple set on it. And so they come. And you say, well, how does that prove to the adversaries that the walls were properly built? Well, also in verse 38, did you see where they walked? The other company of them that gave thanks went to meet them, and I after them, with the half of the people upon the wall. And what did Tobias said? If a fox goes on it, it will break it down. Now all the people who had had a hand in building, all the people that had returned from exile, were now marching on the top of the wall of Jerusalem. What a wonderful sight. I mean, you can understand the sort of man that Nehemiah was. I mean, he was really showing these adversaries what the Jews were made of now. Not only had they built the wall in less than 2 months, but it was a strong, secure wall, and they were really showing the adversaries that they would be more than their match if they thought of attacking them. And they then come, verse 40, so stood the two companies of them that gave thanks in the house of God, and I and the half of the rulers with me, and the priests who are named. At the end of verse 42, the singers sang loud with Jezrehiah their overseer. And that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The wives also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard even, notice that little phrase we looked at earlier this week, afar off. You see, it had happened before, when they'd laid the foundation of the Lord's house, and the joy was heard afar off, and it started a whole lot of opposition to the work. But now we've not only got an altar, we've got a temple, not just its foundations, we've got the whole building. We've got a wall, we've got its gates, we've got a population established in Jerusalem. The process of the exiles returning has now reached its completion. And when that happens, in the ultimate, when God's people from all nations have been gathered to Jerusalem, and all those things are there, then the joy will be heard afar off, and the joy of Jerusalem will be a praise in the earth. This was the sort of thing that Nehemiah was able to do. These are the lessons that he's able to teach us. So when we come to think of the city and those things that we should do if we are going to properly serve God, then let's turn, shall we, to the end of the book of Revelation, chapter 21. Verse 7. He that overcometh shall inherit all things. And you see what's been described earlier in verse 2, the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. The tabernacle of God with men, who will dwell with them, they shall be his people. God himself shall be with them and be their God. He that overcometh shall inherit all these things. And the people afar off, well, they're described, aren't they, in verse 8, the fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, the whoremongers, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, just like those of Sodom and Gomorrah, who were the prototypes of all these people, shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, the second death. And the city, is here in verses 15 and 16. He that taught with me had a golden reed to measure the city, and the gates thereof and the walls thereof. And the city lieth foursquare by the side of the north, the city of the great king. The length as large as the breadth, 12,000 furlongs, the length, the breadth, the height are equal. 144 cubits according to the measure of a man, that is of the angel. And the building of jasper, the city pure gold like unto clear glass. The foundations of the wall garnished with all manner of precious stones. These are the people who, remembering those things which Nehemiah learned and upon whose hope he rested, have shown their brilliances as they have become more like the one who saved them. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city of pure gold. Turn to Isaiah chapter 26. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. I wonder whether this is what they sung under Nehemiah's leadership when they came into the city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation, which keepeth the truth, may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. The time hasn't yet come when this will happen, but week by week, as we take emblems of bread and wine, we remember that this is what they signify. It was the one who had to go without the walls to obtain our salvation who will lead us in through the gate. And the banners will be unfurled, and all the people who have ever rested on the hope that he provided will follow after him. All those names that are known to us in the past, godly men and godly women, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the Sarahs, the Ruths, the Esthers, Mary and Mary, they'll all be there, Ezra, Nehemiah, in that great congregation of people with whom, as we take bread, we also share fellowship. You see, it's remarkable, isn't it? What we do this morning is not bounded by space, because we're in fellowship with all who, wherever in the world today, worship in spirit and in truth. Nor yet by time, because we fellowship with all these people. Nor yet by that other dimension, because we fellowship with the Lord and with his Father. Oh yes, salvation has our God provided for walls and bulwarks. Let's rest upon that thought, and then know that whether we meet people like Tobiah the Ammonite, or Geshem the Arabian, or Sanballat the Horonite, their opposition shall not come nigh us. Verse 5 of Isaiah 26. For he bringeth down them that think they dwell on high, that's what it's really saying, the lofty city, he layeth it low. He layeth it low even to the ground, and bringeth it even to the dust. That word that comes straight out of Genesis 2 and 3. The foot shall tread it down, even the feet of the poor and the steps of the needy. The way of the just is uprightness. Thou most upright, this way the path of the just. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Lord, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the remembrance of thee. What better introduction could we have before we break bread? The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the remembrance of thee.